Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 231, The Meditating Brain with Dr. Richard J. Davidson. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
As we learn more about neuroplasticity, it's increasingly clear that the brain is continuously being shaped by experience. And so we really have a choice as human beings as to whether we wish to let our brains be shaped willy-nilly by the forces which impact upon us, or take a more active responsibility for shaping our own brains in ways to promote more positive kinds of qualities. And the current neuroscience-oriented research indicates that we can indeed take more responsibility and actively promote the more positive shaping of our brains through the explicit cultivation of positive mental states and challenging negative mental states.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Richard Davidson, speaking about his research on meditation and the brain. Richard J. Davidson is the William James and Velas Research Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry, Director of the W.M. Keck Laboratory for Functional Brain Imaging and Behavior, the Laboratory for Effective Neuroscience, and the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds, Weissman Center, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He received his Ph.D. from Harvard University in psychology and has been at Wisconsin since 1984. He's published more than 250 articles, many chapters and reviews, and edited 13 books. He's been a member of the Mind and Life Institute's Board of Directors since 1991. He's the recipient of numerous awards for his research, including a National Institute of Mental Health Research Scientist Award. He was the founding co-editor of the New American Psychological Association journal Emotion and is past president of the Society for Research in Psychopathology and of the Society for Psychophysiological Research. He was named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine in 2006. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Richard Davidson, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm so excited to have you as a guest. We've had to postpone this interview several times due to your very busy schedule, so I'm feeling particularly lucky that you're able to squeeze this in. Seems like everyone I know who refers to your work always refers to you as Richie Davidson. Now, we haven't met in person, but is it okay if I call you Richie?
Absolutely.
Okay. A little presumptuous of me, but I hope you don't mind.
Not at all.
Okay, great. Well, your recent work, broadly speaking, seems to explore two domains. One is the neuroscience of meditation, and maybe they're not this separate, but the other is the neuroscience of emotion. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I see them as intimately related, and I don't make a rigid separation. We do all kinds of other work related to those issues as well.
Yes, I was on your website, and I saw that, in fact, you have a really diverse range of projects going. But I thought in the time that we have together, I'd like to focus on both of those areas, but I'd like to start with your work on meditation. So I wonder if I could, can I ask you, what drew you to that area in the first place?
Well, what drew me to that area was first of all, my own personal practice, which has convinced me that there's something very important there, and that we have within each of us the capacity to change our own mind and brain through systematic mental training. And the contemplative traditions have, I think, much to offer in delineating specific methods and procedures for training the mind and cultivating certain positive qualities. I also believe that positive qualities like happiness and kindness and compassion are all best regarded as the product of skills which can be enhanced through training. And all of that meshes very well with modern understanding from neuroscience of plasticity and the fact that circuits in the brain can be shaped through experience and training. And all of this really makes a lot of sense from both the contemplative perspectives as well as from scientific perspectives.
Yeah, so you were already a meditator when you began your research. What year did you start doing your brain research on meditation?
Well, I actually dabbled in it in the very early part of my career and actually published a few papers in the late 1970s from graduate school and immediately postgraduate school. But it became apparent that the times just weren't right for research in this area. The methods were not sufficiently sophisticated, and the cultural climate in science was not particularly receptive. And I then took it up again in the around 2000 after I met the Dalai Lama for the first time, and he encouraged me to pursue research in this area. So it was really in the around 1999 or 2000 that we began this work in earnest in kind of the modern era, and it's expanded very dramatically since then.
It's interesting to me that you picked it up in the 70s and then put it down, because actually my own doctoral dissertation I did in 1970 and attempted to study meditation at the University of Michigan. And of course, I didn't have access to any tools for studying the brain, and so my approach was really crude. So it's interesting that you took that initial stab, and then you the technology kind of caught up to where you were trying to go.
Yeah, I remember the study you did. It was something on stimulus-independent thought or mind-wandering, something like that.
Yeah, well, the mind-wandering part, I was hypothesizing that attention was played a key role, and I had people in a soundproof chamber following their breath or following a candle and clicking a counter every time that they needed to bring themselves back to the task. So,
right.
So I'm flattered that you remember that study.
Yeah.
Can you take us through the highlights of your brain imaging research with meditators? I know you spoke about plasticity, and I think actually you're one of the key people to help establish that finding.
Well, the work we're doing is diverse and extensive in meditation. It includes the study of very long-term practitioners who've been practicing for tens of thousands of hours across their lifetime.
Wow.
And in those studies, we have been having the practitioners meditate in the laboratory to learn what we can about the specific neural correlates of different types of meditation. We've been doing a lot of work on compassion meditation and trying to discover what networks might be recruited in the brain during the voluntary generation of compassion, and how that kind of practice may transform the processing of emotional stimuli. We have also been looking at the impact of more of other kinds of meditation practices, ones that involve specifically focusing attention on circuitry implicated in attention and behavioral tasks that may be sensitive to that, such as the attentional blink and other methods for interrogating different aspects of attention. In other work, we have looked at practitioners longitudinally over the course of intensive practice. So we've done and published several studies over the course of the three-month retreat, where we have looked at practitioners before and after a three-month retreat and looked at changes in the brain and behavior, mostly in this case focusing on indices of attention. There have been a number of papers published from that, and we've been able to demonstrate enhancements in different subcomponents of attention and alterations in neural systems that may underlie them. And then in other work, we have looked at really more novice practitioners, including individuals going through mindfulness-based stress reduction, an eight-week course where practitioners attend 1 2.5-hour class a week and then have daily homework. And we have looked at changes in the brain and in peripheral biology, biology below the neck, particularly immune function, and also changes in behavior that are associated with this short-term practice. And in still other work, we have done studies with even shorter-term practice on the order of 2 weeks of daily practice to see whether just a little bit of practice can make a difference. And in those studies, which are not yet published, we indeed have found that even short-term practice can change the brain and behavior in reliable ways. So that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of what we've been doing, and we are continuing with studies in all of those domains now to further explore some of these questions.
Well, that's a very big thumbnail. It's a lot of ground that you covered there. You've studied all these different lengths of time, and what are you able to conclude? If, you know, you've studied novices, you've studied lengths of time as short as 2 weeks. You've studied people who are relative novices in meditation versus people who have put in tens of thousands of hours. Is there any way to make a generalization about that?
Yeah, there is a way. And I would say that the general conclusions we've been able to glean from looking at practitioners of varying different lengths of practice is this. One is that even really short amounts of practice in complete novice practitioners has discernible effects. So when people ask if even just a few minutes of practice a day can make a difference, I think the answer is unequivocally yes. The second generalization is that in many cases there is a relation that we've been able to uncover between how much a person practices and the magnitude of changes in different indices. So the second general conclusion is that more practice leads to greater improvements. And the third generalization, I would say, is that some of these relationships are nonlinear. That is, it's not necessarily the case that the relationship between the amount of practice and the magnitude of change is a strictly linear one, because in some cases we don't find these relationships, and in certain cases there is some reason to believe that the magnitude of change early on may actually be greater because there's more room to see improvement, at least on certain measures. So those are general conclusions, I think, that we can draw from these studies.
Are you finding that any particular approach to meditation appears to be more impactful neurologically than others?
You mean specific meditation practices?
Yes.
No, I would not say that. I wouldn't say more impactful. I would say that different practices are differently impactful. Mm-hmm. They impact different systems. But I wouldn't say that there's one practice which may be more impactful than others. And I would hasten to add that one of the things that I think is going to be true is that one size does not fit all. And what's impactful for one person may not produce any change for another person. And I think that one of the most important questions that needs to be addressed in scientific research in this area is which individuals benefit most from which kinds of practices. And that's something that we really don't have a lot of evidence on yet, but I expect over the next few years there'll be more relevant data.
Oh, that sounds like a fascinating line of research. Now, you were also talking about below the neck and the immune system. Can you say something about the significance of that work and those findings?
Sure. Well, to give a very concrete example first, in one study that we published several years ago, we demonstrated that individuals going through an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction course had significantly enhanced antibody titers in response to an influenza vaccine, compared to a control group. This is a good measure of systemic immunocompetence. It's an in vivo measure, and what it means is that simply going through 8 weeks of meditation actually enhanced a person's response to the vaccine, so that if these groups were exposed to comparable levels of virus, the individuals who went through the meditation training would more likely demonstrate greater resistance to the virus from the vaccine. And we also found in that study that the magnitude of changes in certain aspects of the neural response among the meditators predicted how much change they exhibited in the immune system. These data demonstrate that the changes that are induced by meditation practice are not just in the mind and the brain, but they also affect bodily systems that are intimately connected in a bidirectional way to these neural systems. Certainly the immune system is, or aspects of the immune system are, I think, going to turn out to be extremely important in this regard. In very recent work, which is not yet published, we're intensively studying immunological contributions to inflammation and looking at different cytokines that have been implicated in inflammatory processes to examine in a very detailed way how meditation may impact these systems.
I recently had the privilege of interviewing Sarah Lazar about her brain imaging studies of meditators. What are the similarities and or differences in your approaches and findings?
Well, I think the approach that we're taking is broadly similar. I assume Sarah was talking about her structural imaging findings mostly. I think that those are very, very interesting and raise the possibility that meditation may lead to structural changes in the brain. Of course, comparing two different groups on structural brain measures and finding differences doesn't necessarily mean that it's meditation that produced those differences. That's a criticism which is relevant to studies that we've done on functional changes in the brain. So it's not unique to structural changes, but it's particularly important in examining structural changes to look at longitudinal changes over time within the same individuals, which will give us a more definitive understanding of how meditation may lead to structural differences.
You know, speaking of criticism, I'm under the impression that there's been some criticism of the fMRI and maybe EEG, I'm not sure, as rather blunt instruments that have led to unwarranted claims. A friend sent me a reference to a report in Science News that raises questions about the underlying assumptions and statistical techniques used with fMRI. For example, the assumption that blood flow reflects neural activity, and some critics evidently have referred to the research as, quotes, the new phrenology. Can you comment on this?
Well, these are general criticisms of research with human brain imaging method. They weren't criticisms specifically of the research in meditation, unless you're referring to something I don't know about.
No.
Yeah. Well, I think that the criticisms of the methods used in brain imaging research are important to acknowledge, and many of them are valid and need to be, and so conclusions need to be tempered in light of the fact that they are very blunt and coarse in terms of what we can infer from them. The bottom line, though, is that they're the best we have right now for non-invasive measurement. So, I mean, on and on about that, and there are a lot of technical issues that are interesting and important, but I suspect that they would really not be relevant to the average listener.
Okay. Yeah, you've touched on this a bit already, but from a scientific point of view, what big questions or challenges remain in relation to the neuroscience of meditation?
Well, I think that one of the big challenges is one that I alluded to, which is the idea that it's likely that one size does not fit all. And how can we better understand an individual's unique cognitive and emotional style and make predictions about what specific kinds of practice may be most efficacious for a given individual with a given style? That's something that's really important. And it's particularly important because anecdotal evidence suggests that most people who start with a particular kind of meditation don't stick with it, although those data are very hard to come by. But it's my impression, for example, that the majority of people, for example, who take a mindfulness-based stress reduction course, although they, by their own report, get a lot out of it, most people don't stick with a daily practice. And so this leads to the question as to how can we optimize the match between a person's cognitive and emotional style and a method for mental training that may harness their individual differences. So that's one big challenge. I would say a second big challenge, which we haven't spoken at all about, is how can we develop optimize methods of meditation training for children in a way that's developmentally appropriate. We know that the brain is more plastic earlier on in life, and there is a lot of reason to believe that if this kind of training begins earlier in life, it will produce more enduring changes. And that's something that a number of people, including our group, is currently working on, and I think we'll be hearing a lot more about that within the next decade. So that's another big area. And I'd say a third big area is how meditation might induce changes in gene expression. The field of epigenetics is just blossoming now, and understanding how genes are regulated by environmental factors is something at the forefront of molecular genetics. And understanding how meditation can induce changes in local gene expression in the brain is something that is a major frontier, and I think the prospects for new discovery there are enormous.
Okay, thanks. Those are each sound like very, very fascinating areas. In relation to the first, I think I myself am one of those sort of off again, on again meditators in terms of developing the discipline. At the same time, I feel like I've integrated an attitude of mindfulness in my life where in daily life I feel like I'm being, quotes, more mindful, more aware of my attitudes and thoughts and kind of monitoring them. And I don't know if you're able to assess whether that's whether that counts or not.
Well, you know, my own intuition is that it counts. Just how to measure it is a big challenge.
Sure.
You know, that's another area where I think scientific development will be very important. That is, in measuring qualities of mindfulness in an objective way.
And you mentioned children, and it made me think of children in Tibetan monasteries that, you know, that there might be a subject population right there. Have you, in fact, done any studies with children at this point?
Not children in Tibetan monasteries. We are doing studies with children in the U.S. who are being taught practices in a developmentally appropriate way. Young children in Tibetan monasteries actually are not taught meditation. So that's, you know, most people assume that the young children meditate. They don't, really.
I had assumed that.
Formal meditation is not introduced until the teens.
Well, that's interesting. And what's the rationale for that? I'm sure they have some understanding of why that's developmentally appropriate.
Well, you know, there are other kinds of skills which are cultivated prior to formal meditation, and they apparently have sort of arrived at a sequence that they think may be optimal, but whether it's optimal for children across culture is not known, and you know, the Dalai Lama has encouraged us to explore the possibility of modifying these practices in ways that may be useful for children in the Western context.
I had announced on a previous show that I was going to be interviewing you and ask listeners to submit questions, and so I've got one from one of my listeners here. It's got a little bit of a long introduction, but here it is. This listener writes, "I'm an undergraduate student pursuing a BS in psychology. I sometimes find myself disenchanted with the shallow explanations my textbooks offer to explain aspects of human experience that seem to elude current scientific knowledge. For instance, Francis Crick famously proclaimed that your joys, your sorrows, your memories, and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Others have claimed that feelings of compassion and transcendence, often labeled mystical experiences, are no more than excessive activation of specific circuits in the temporal lobe of the brain. What do you think? Can the entirety of the human experience be encapsulated in scientific explanations? If not, do you think that your research on how experiences like compassion and mindfulness during a meditation occur at a neurological level sometimes contributes to a reductionist belief by the general public that we are only our brains?" Did you follow that question?
Yes, basically. I think it's a good question, and I appreciate where it's coming from. I have a mixed response to the question. I think that as a scientist, I have a sense of awe and wonderment about the brain, and to say that it's just the brain. Mm. The brain, I think, just a tremendous disservice. because it doesn't really explain anything. We don't know how it is that we can voluntarily move our hand, let alone generate feelings like compassion and have, you know, these extremely complex mental processes. And so the brain is still very much a huge mystery, and I don't think it does anyone a service to say, well, it's just the brain, because just the brain is, in fact, the most complex, least understood, and most important pieces of matter that exist on the planet. And so I think it should be with a sense of awe and reverence that we consider the complexity of the brain and underscore how little it is that we actually know about the brain, and cultivate a sense of humility about it. So that's kind of how I would respond. I know it's not exactly a direct response, but I think that at this point in time, it really is the most appropriate response.
Okay, and you can decline this next question if you'd like, but I think maybe it's a spin-off of the previous question. Do you think consciousness exists beyond the neural activity of the brain? Or beyond the body, I guess?
I have no idea, and I don't think that we're remotely close to being able to address that scientifically at this point in time.
Okay. On a slightly different topic, do you have any experience or opinions on binaural audio brain driver software that purports to facilitate meditation? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. I don't know the claims in detail. I also don't believe there are any really good data to support those claims. I am open but skeptical.
Okay. You mentioned the Dalai Lama earlier, and I see that you're on the board of the Mind and Life Institute, which seeks to promote a dialogue between Western science and Eastern contemplative traditions. And I know, and through reading and so on, I know that you've had quite a bit of contact with the Dalai Lama. Can you say something about your impressions of him, as well as his interest in promoting scientific investigation of Buddhist practices?
Well, with respect to the latter question, he is deeply curious, intensely interested, and really has made a rather remarkable and extraordinary commitment to interacting with scientists and encouraging scientific investigation of these questions. He spends more time with scientists than I think the collective body of heads of state, in the Western world. It's really a remarkable commitment. In terms of my own impressions of the Dalai Lama, I think he is a really extraordinary person, and you really feel his compassion when you're in his presence, in my experience. And he is someone who I find is able to teach by example in a very powerful way. And I think that whenever I can, it's wonderful to bring other scientists into contact with him, because I find that they always learn something very important through their interactions with him, because he so powerfully conveys by example what the further reaches of human transformation, I think, are.
You know, synchronistically, I just discovered that there's this PBS Nova series out, the third episode of which actually you're in it, and the Dalai Lama is in it, and so on. It's called This Emotional Life. And mm-hmm. And so it was fascinating to, in there it's recounted that in initial invitation from the Dalai Lama, you packed up a lot of gear and took it off to India to do brain measurements there, only to discover that that they weren't as open to it as you had hoped. But then later the Dalai Lama sent monks to this country so that you could study them intensively.
Right.
Yeah, all of that was really fascinating. Well, let's turn our attention to some of the other work that you're doing. You're the director of a major lab on effective neuroscience, and I see from your website that you tackle a broad range of issues there. What's currently hot in your lab, sort of non-meditation-wise? For example, I saw references to resilience and aging, which is of interest and relevance to me. I saw work on mood and anxiety disorders. What's sort of front and center right now?
Well, a major issue front and center is to better understand the nature of emotion regulation. We believe that the capacity to regulate emotion, both consciously as well as non-consciously, we might say through voluntary means versus through more automatic means, is something that lies at the heart of individual differences in emotional style, emotional reactivity, and also is central to understanding why certain individuals may be vulnerable to particular kinds of psychiatric disorders in the face of adversity, and while other individuals, why other individuals may be resilient be relatively immune to the development of such disorders. So we have been very interested in better understanding the neural bases of emotion regulation, and also how individual differences in emotion regulation relate to peripheral biology, health, and so forth. So, and some of those studies are done in older individuals because this is where variations in emotion regulation can become sort of manifestly expressed in variations in health status. So those are all questions that we are actively pursuing in other aspects of our laboratory's work.
Well, as we begin to wind down here, I wonder if there's any sort of final statement that you'd like to make, or perhaps there's something that you had sort of hoped to say that I haven't elicited in my questioning.
Well, I would just conclude by underscoring the fact that as we learn more about neuroplasticity, it's increasingly clear that the brain is continuously being shaped by experience. And so we really have a choice as human beings as to whether we wish to let our brains be shaped willy-nilly by the forces which impact upon us, or take a more active responsibility for shaping our own brains in ways to promote more positive kinds of qualities. And the current neuroscience-oriented research indicates that we can indeed take more responsibility and actively promote the more positive shaping of our brains through the explicit cultivation of positive mental states and challenging negative mental states. Doing so leads to systematic changes in the brain, which can be enduring and may be important not just for our emotional well-being, but for our physical well-being as well.
Well, that's a terrific wrap-up. So, Dr. Richie Davidson, thanks so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule and for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You are most welcome. It was a pleasure to talk with you today.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Richard Davidson. I have to confess, I was a little nervous. Frankly, I'm awed by his stature in the field and all that he's managed to accomplish, and by the fact that he is really on the cutting edge of so much important research, I was having a little trouble thinking on my feet. Right after the interview was over, I found myself wishing I had thought to ask if he's found any difference between concentrative meditation, such as focusing on your breath, a candle, or a mantra, and a more open-ended, receptive approach to meditation in which you're simply watching your thoughts as they go by. I suspect that might be something he's looked into. Also, there was a sort of half-formed question that never quite reached my lips along the lines of wondering how he might answer a skeptic who'd say, "What's the big deal? If we accept the idea that mind and body are two sides of the same coin, then why should we be surprised to find brain correlates or other bodily responses that co-vary with meditation? Wouldn't we expect to also find a variety of brain changes that might result from frequent singing, for example, or movie watching?" I think it's a reasonable question, and I'm sure he'd have a good answer for it, but I think some part of my mind was labeling it as a dumb question. I think another piece of my nervousness was that we needed to schedule this interview a couple of hours earlier in the morning than I'm used to, and so I was rushing to get my setup together in time, and my brain wasn't fully awake yet. I mentioned that three-part public television series on emotions. You really should try to track it down and watch it if you can. You'll get to see Dr. Davidson and the Dalai Lama. In that same third episode, you'll also see another one of my interviewees, Dr. Fred Luskin, speaking about his work on forgiveness. It felt so synchronistic that I should stumble across that TV show just yesterday, both because of my interview with Dr. Davidson today, and also because the whole episode has a focus on positive psychology and happiness, and I'm giving the first of two lectures on that very topic tomorrow at Sonoma State University in their lifelong learning program. There's so much information about positive psychology coming out so fast in the media that it's going to be challenging for me to say anything people haven't already heard. At least that's my concern. If you're interested in the work that Dr. Davidson is doing, I really urge you to visit his website at the University of Wisconsin. There will be a link to it in the show notes. The URL is too long to read out here, but you'll find it quickly, as I did, if you Google him mindfully.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Davis here to remind you it's all in your mind.
Hi all, I've got lots of new information to share with you. First of all, there are some new items in the Shrink Wrap Radio store for you on our site. I've created a CD just for you with the two lectures I recently gave on positive psychology and the quest for happiness. I put both lectures on a single CD to give you greater value for your money. In addition, this CD includes the handout that I passed out to the group with recommended readings and recommended Shrink Wrap Radio episodes related to positive psychology. And beyond that, you also get my PowerPoint presentation so that you'll be able to follow along, just as if you were there. You get both lectures for just $15 plus shipping. Your CD comes in a beautiful DVD-style case, which will fit nicely on your bookshelf. Now, in addition, I've created a series of archive CDs for you. Each CD holds the MP3 files for 25 shows. Currently, there are three such archival CDs in the store, priced at what I hope will be an affordable $9.95 each plus shipping. That's about 40 cents an episode. Yes, you could download these first 75 back episodes one at a time for free. But if you haven't listened to them already, this is the quickest and easiest way to get them all onto your hard drive or MP3 player. Plus, they might make a lovely gift for the right person or persons. So please go to the store tab on the shrinkwrapradio.com website. And while you're on our website, you might take a look under the About Dr. Dave tab, where I've added a photo of my new iPhone case. Last weekend, I went to the annual Macworld conference in San Francisco and discovered a company that will create custom iPhone cases from your own artwork. I guess I'm a fanatic because I felt I had to personalize my iPhone with the Shrink Wrap Radio logo. So check out the photo under About Dr. Dave. And no, I won't try to sell you one. On the latest Wise Counsel podcast, you can hear my initial foray into interviewing a non-psychologist celebrity. Mary Weiland is a former supermodel and the ex-wife of Scott Weiland of the 70s rock group The Stone Temple Pilots. She's written a tell-all book about her celebrity life and her struggles with addiction and bipolar disorder. In her book, she talks about friendships with the likes of Carmen Diaz, Charlize Theron, Drew Barrymore, and Nicolas Cage, among others. The book is a real page-turner, I must say, and you'll find my interview and transcript of the interview at wisecounselpodcast.com. As I mentioned last time, my two podcasts are covered in the February issue of the American Psychological Association's monthly magazine, The Monitor. You'll find a link to that article, Giving Psychology Away, One Podcast at a Time, under the In the Media tab at the top of the Shrink Wrap Radio homepage. You'll also recall that I'm going to be giving a presentation in Prague in mid-May titled Marketing and Happiness Through the Looking Glass of Positive Psychology. Well, consulting a map, I see that Vienna is only 150 miles from Prague. So since I've never been to Vienna, I'm planning to extend my stay a day or two and hop on a train to Vienna. So if you're a listener in either Vienna or Prague and would like to get together, be sure to drop me an email. Finally, let me remind you that this show is supported by your generous donations, both those that are one-time and those that are continuing for 6 or 12 months. Thank you so much for your support.
Hi, this is Dr. Karen Sherman, author of Mindfulness and the Art of Choice, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Karen Sherman. And as you've probably guessed, she'll be my next guest on the next episode. Now for something different. I recently heard from a new listener, Dina Chappell, who is a singer-songwriter with a new CD. And here's what she wrote. Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Dina, and I'm one of your newest fans. I love your program. Last August, I graduated from Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont, with an MA in liberal arts. My thesis was based around Carl Jung's theories of individuation and transcendent function combined with Joseph Campbell's work with personal mythology. I am also a professional musician, singer, songwriter. My education culminated in a creative project that took the form of a compilation of original songs entitled Voices of the Archetypes. Each song represents a particular archetype or archetypal experience that I encountered in my journey of individuation thus far. I would like to invite you to have a listen. Perhaps you'd like to play a song or two on your show. At the very least, I would appreciate any feedback that you may have. Please visit www.dinachappell.com. Peace, Dina. So let me go ahead and share one of the cuts from her CD. It's titled Song for Child, which I'm assuming is a reference to the inner divine child archetype. I had a little trouble catching the words over the music when I listened to it, and that could be due to my own failing hearing. Let me read the lyrics to you, and then I'll play the song. Again, it's called Song for Child. Holding you, breathing in your innocence, I can feel your heart right next to mine. Enfolding you, glimpsing your intelligence, I have finally touched the true divine. Take my hand, I am here to learn from you. All of my defenses have come down. Now we can find the beauty in the truth within the beauty can be found. And then the chorus, I see the whole earth through your eyes, I hear the sweet wind through your ears. The sun and moon are new to me again. Your laughter is a melody that carries me throughout the years, showing me the pathway to transcend. And then a final verse, Precious One, communicating with the universe, throwing ourselves toward the great who knows. And this is fun. You've inspired another verse, and I'm so glad that I'm the one you chose. And then the chorus again, I see the whole earth through your eyes, I hear the sweet wind through your ears. The sun and moon are new to me again. Your laughter is a melody that carries me throughout the years, showing me the pathway to transcend. Now here comes the song. First you'll hear children at play in the background, and then the song itself. Dina, thanks so much for sharing this with us. How great that Goddard provided you with the opportunity to follow your bliss. If you'd like to hear more of Dina's archetypal compositions, or even to purchase individual songs or her whole CD, you can go to her website. The URL for that is http://dinachappell.bandcamp.com. And Dina's name is spelled DeenaChapple. And Dina, please accept my apologies if I got that pronunciation wrong. So I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember to send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. I hope to hear from you. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Richard Davidson, for sharing his groundbreaking work on the neuroscience of meditation. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. Karen Sherman about mindfulness and the art of choice. Please do choose to be with us then. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.